Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arzuma Sini and I'm delighted welcoming tonight's guests, graffiti artist, tattooist, and co-author of Skin Graph, Michael McLear, known as Caves, cultural documentarian, entrepreneur, and co-author of Skin Graph, Billy Burke, and writer, television producer, and musician, Sasha Jenkins. We are here tonight to celebrate the publication of Skin Graph, Graffiti Tattoo, with a discussion and book signing. This lavishly illustrated book reveals the convergence of two distinct art forms, graffiti and tattoo, and it showcases the comprehensive works of 10 prominent East and West Coast masters of this influential new style. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in the Design and Style Series event. Copies of the book, Skin Graph, Masters of Graffiti Tattoo, are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of the program. Also encouraging all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can openly browse one of the largest and most comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of graffiti and tattoo art. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Thank you all for coming out. My name is Sasha Jenkins, and I grew up in Queens, New York for many years, relocating at a very young age from Silver Spring, Maryland to Astoria, Queens. And the first day I went outside, you know, my mom told me, this is back in the 70s where your mom could tell you to just go outside with a football and make friends. And I went outside with a football to make friends, and I was the only one with a football, and everyone else had a magic marker, and I said, well, what is this? And a kid handed me a magic marker and said, it's, you know, you make up your own name, you write your name on the slide, you come up with an alias. And I was fascinated by that because my mom was a painter and my dad was a documentary filmmaker. So at a young age, I kind of fell into being someone who was somewhat of a participant and also somewhat of an observer of culture. And at the time, I wasn't thinking it was culture, it was just my life. It was how we all grew up. We played football, we played stickball, and we wrote graffiti. That was just a part of our cultural experience here in New York City. I've since gone on to produce some books and things on the subject, and I've had the wonderful opportunity to work with our friends at Prestel and produce a number of books on the subject of graffiti. And in thinking about what hadn't been discussed yet and what was a really important movement inside of graffiti culture, this young man I've known for many years, he grew up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which is sort of like the evil twin of Astoria, Queens, and had very similar experiences growing up. So we've been friends for many years, and he was this graffiti artist who, like a lot of my friends who are graffiti artists, transitioned into tattoo and tattoo culture. So for many years, he had been kicking around the idea. He became friends with Billy, who, among many other things, is really plugged into the traditional or just tattoo culture in general, the industry of tattoo, movers and shakers. They had, you know, formed a friendship. And so this idea of a book about the merging of these cultures was something that they were kicking around for some time and came to me, and we developed the project. And, you know, here, the beautiful book that is for sale here, you can purchase. But what was interesting for me in, you know, I conducted a lot of the interviews for the book, and we spoke to artists from Massachusetts and California and, you know, all over the United States. Geographically, they're all from different places, but they are all connected. There's a relationship. All of these folks somehow know one another, and it all sort of ties back to, you know, where it all started and how it all started. And I think whenever you have that kind of connectivity, it demonstrates the power of a community and the power of a movement. And we'll get into, you know, general ideas about the history of tattoo, which Billy can sort of walk us through and set things up. But there are very interesting and powerful parallels between the evolution of tattoo culture and graffiti culture, and why eventually it made so much sense for them to join and become one. You know, before there was graffiti, there were sailors, and we all know maybe we had a grandfather in World War II, or, you know, we knew those guys had tattoos, or we knew guys who were outlaw bikers had tattoos, and there are very specific aesthetics associated with being a sailor or being a biker. Well, graffiti has very particular and specific aesthetics that this movement, with folks like this guy and some of the young men in the audience, you know, ushered in that sensibility and that touch and feel and applied it to something that was around for a long time and had a lot of history. And Billy can sort of take us through some of that.
Thank you. So, yeah, I'm going to go through just a brief little history of Western tattooing and kind of what got us here today. So the first thing that I'm going to, the first slide that I'm going to show is one of Ozzy the Iceman. And this was the oldest body ever found.
I'm getting some, feedback or?
No, just
depending on. Okay, cool.
All right. So Ozzy the Iceman was found in the Italian and Austrian Alps on the border. And he was found frozen. So he believed to come from 3,300 BC, right? So but because he was frozen, his skin was pretty much left intact, and they found tattoos on his body. So he had markings on his body. So the oldest, person per se ever discovered, right, was found with tattoos. So what does that tell us? We know that tattoos have been around since the beginning of man. You know, the idea of or actually physically marking oneself. This next slide is a cave painting that was discovered in Spain. It's believed to be 40,000 years old. And what this shows us is that the same inherent thing that human beings kind of had to mark themselves, they also had that same feeling to mark a wall, right? To not only mark their skin, but to mark, something else, and here being, a cave. So fast forward, we get to Captain James Cook. And in between 1766 and 1779, he took three voyages to the South Pacific. And on one of these voyages, he ended up in Tahiti. And it was in 1769 that Cook first coined the name tattoo. It was the first time the word tattoo was ever recorded. Where it came from was originally tatau. And tatau was the tapping. They would call it tatau because it was the sound that these Polynesian artists were making when they would use these instruments to mark skin. Right? They put these kind of tribal imagery on each other. And that brings us, so now this idea, right, of tattoo, and this word tattoo now comes into Western culture. And we see Samuel O'Reilly, who was a successful New York tattoo artist and was the inventor of the modern-day rotary tattoo machine. So as it was happening in the South Pacific and being done by hand using these kind of poking instruments, in 1891, the rotary tattoo machine was patented by Samuel O'Reilly. Okay, and that is when, as Western tattooists, we developed our own tools, right, and started to use that to apply marks to the body. Here we see Sailor Jerry. So Sailor Jerry, in the 1920s, after meeting Tats Thomas, went on to sail the world and eventually end up in Hawaii. And he was a very prolific tattooer. And what Sailor Jerry did, like many other sailors, were on these voyages or these shore leaves, would end up in places like Samoa or places like New Zealand, right, and start to discover these kind of tribal marks, right? Ending up in Japan, Tabori tattooing, another, tattoo, a way of marking one's skin that, dates back 400 years. So in discovering this, they brought it home, and they created iconography that was representative of their experiences, right, their experiences, at sea. and created these kind of nautical images that were more reflective of who they were, right, and kind of making tattoo their own. And this was, like as Sasha mentioned before, this happening, you know, in, say, World War II, if you had grandfathers or, you know, who may have had these kind of marks on their body, well, this is, you know, the impetus of it. Fast forward to the Vietnam War. So 1955 to 1975, you had young men, you know, sent off to Vietnam who spent years in the trenches kind of, you know, going through, having these horrific experiences. They come home from war, and, you know, whether society at the time wasn't too accepting, or if, you know, they felt as if no one understood what they went through other than those that were there with them, they were looking for the brotherhood or the camaraderie that they once had while being in Vietnam here in the U.S. At the same time, there was this whole counterculture movement happening, and that gave birth to outlaw motorcycle clubs. So outlaw motorcycle clubs come from, you know, bands of Vietnam vets who came home from war and were looking to unify with people and kind of, you know, walk to the beat of their own drum. These folks also really developed a fascination with tattooing. And we saw a huge cultural shift. So it went away from this kind of sailor imagery and the sailor iconography and became... And they start to develop this own style unto themselves, right? And these, you know, FTW and TCB and these kind of like tattoos that became prominent within outlaw motorcycle culture.
1%.
And 1% movement. And this is what a tattoo artist, you know, from let's say the 70s and 80s and 90s started to look like in a lot of people's minds and actually... truly exist. I mean, this is Gil Monty. He's a ex-Vietnam vet, famous tattoo artist, was a member of an outlaw motorcycle club and at one time, and a very famous tattoo artist. So this was, you know, up until where we're going to get to with this book, this is what tattooing may or may not have been in the United States, but it definitely, you know, outlaw motorcycle culture definitely had a large influence within the tattoo community for those 3 decades. And that brings us to Taki 183. And this is where we're going to start to try to show you as while that was happening and there was that whole outlaw movement within motorcycle culture, there was this other outlaw movement happening, outlaw art movement within graffiti culture.
You want to pick up on that?
Yeah, and you know, New York in the early to mid-70s was basically bankrupt. So you had this culture of young kids initially, you know, writing their names in their neighborhoods, you know, just to have local recognition, you know, from their peers. Eventually, guys like Taki 183, who apparently was a messenger, that was his job, you know, while he walked around the city, he wrote his name all over the place, and he was sort of the first, you know, I wouldn't say graffiti artist, but graffiti writer. And within the culture of graffiti, they called themselves writers. You know, graffiti was actually a term that was applied by the media and now embraced by many and shunned by others within the culture. But, you know, Taki was the first writer to get this recognition by the New York Times. And as it says there, Taki 183 spawns pen pals. And so... early 70s, you had more of, again, as I described when I, you know, moved to New York in 1977, there were still remnants of, you know, graffiti was just something that kids did. It wasn't even, you know, it wasn't what we know it today as this, you know, international art movement. It was basically kids just writing their names. And eventually it became more and more competitive. Eventually, you know, the idea was to get your name seen by as many people as possible, and during the 70s, you still had a very strong contingency of gangs, so things were very territorial. So initially, the notion of going to different neighborhoods was a very dangerous prospect, but with the rise of the graffiti artists, eventually the gangs started to recognize, well, this guy's not from my neighborhood, but he's not a threat. He's not here really to war with me. He just wants to write his name. And so the evolution of the graffiti artist actually, to a certain extent, helped to make New York City, for young people, a broader sort of palette of expression. Because typically, unless you were on a sports team, you know, kids typically stayed in their neighborhoods. And what was also very interesting about graffiti is it was rich white kids, poor white kids, poor Latin kids, rich, you know, a really broad range of kids from all over New York City, you know, started to participate in the subculture that very simply, you know, wasn't about galleries, it wasn't about making money, it was just about, I want to be recognized by my peers. I want to be recognized now, not only by peers in my neighborhood, if I'm writing my name on a subway train that goes from the Bronx to Brooklyn, now I'm starting to develop a name for myself that goes beyond my neighborhood. And I often equate the graffiti subway movement to the internet before the internet. You know, it's the subway trains are like an information superhighway. And, you know, these words would travel very far, at least far. You know, the internet is the world, but for a kid in the 70s in New York, you know, traveling from Brooklyn to the Bronx was a really big deal. So you look at New York is bankrupt, you know, kids are writing their names all over the place, and you look at something like this image shot by a photographer named John Narr. If you look to the top right, you'll see kind of signatures or what might look to you as squiggles. But then you see this thing here with the spray paint. It's like silver and yellow and red and black, and it says Jace 2. And this is a very simple way to sort of look at how graffiti writing evolved. You have all these names, and eventually there's no room. There's no room to write your name. So what's the next step? Well, you draw an arrow at the end of your thing. Well, I'm going to draw an arrow way bigger than yours, and I'm going to make my name bigger than everyone else's. So because of this sort of competitive spirit of, again, not about money or galleries or anything else, just about wanting recognition within their peer group, this evolution of, well, what am I going to do to top the next person? What am I going to do creatively that's going to make me stand out? And so, again, if you look at this photograph, and this is from 1973, I'm pretty sure, which is, you know, very early in the stages of development, you see that this guy, Jace 2, wanted to stand out. He wanted to be noticed. He wanted to be recognized.
But I think before we even get to the next slide, too, what I want to say here is if you go back now, right, to this, to the second slide, to that cave, you know, that was found in Spain from 40,000 years ago, right, is a similar parallel, right, where you have writers, you know, in the caves or subway tunnels of New York City marking walls, right? So, you know, again, this kind of outlaw art form going back to the beginning of man.
In other words, there were weirdos even back then.
Right. And also that whole outlaw sentiment, right, about tattoo artists being outlaws and, you know, outlaw motorcycle culture and outlaw motorcycle clubs and the impact that had on tattooing. Well, these young graffiti writers, right, were outlaws in their own right as well.
So you growing up as a street kid in New York City, early 80s. When I say street kid, you could have been any, black, Puerto Rican, white. You needed something to grab onto. You needed to be heard. So if you're running around the streets of New York, let's take it back to 1982, 81, who's the neighborhood celebrity or the neighborhood off the Fonzarelli, you know? It was basically Mikey Tattoo. Mikey Angelo was the famous street guy for tattooing. Or there was Lee Cleones or Don, graffiti artist. I mean, graffiti was blowing up. It was all over the newspapers, Village Voice. It was a way that kids were communicating. And what the way kids were communicating, coming of age, you went to a tattoo parlor. And you got, you know, your name with the rose or mom. Because you know you better get mom, because if you go home, mom's gonna kick your ass because you got a tattoo. So it was a self-expression, but it was look at me, I'm a big boy now, or you know, I'm expressing myself, I'm reinventing myself, I'm coming of age, and this is what graffiti, like as a young child, you were like, okay, I could do this. I mean, if you couldn't afford going to baseball or football, or, and like I said, you were a street kid, this was something like, hey, I can get famous, I can be heard, I'm going to make my mark. So
I'm going to stop the bomb train. Right?
Stop the bomb train, but this was like perfect example. Like, how does young people, you know, communicate with each other? I didn't know nothing about politics or nuclear war, but Lee was older, and he was already, you know, making his message on the train. So we were on the trains, and we were learning and communicating about politics, about music, about, you know, the everyday struggle. So you see a lot of kids, they'd be in a tattoo parlor, or they would be at the writer's bench getting together to plan their next masterpiece. But the whole point is that kids in New York City in that time, you know, was disenfranchised. They were looking for something to call their own. So graffiti was something that blew up. And the parallel to tattooing, that was also blowing up. But on the underground level, tattooing was illegal, so was graffiti. There wasn't a lot of guys doing it. You had to be mentored into it. There's like a mentorship. Like, you ask anybody that went into a tattoo parlor back then, shut up, sit down, and wait your turn, write your name on the board, and you're lucky to speak to the tattoo artist. Same with the graffiti artist. You had to, like, you know, you had to know somebody that knew that guy, and that guy had to take a liking to you, and they had something called a black book, or they would hand down a penmanship, or, you know, the language. And the same thing with a tattoo apprenticeship. It's like, you're not, you know, you're going to have to go really pay your dues. So that's how this for me as a child, I was always in love with, my father came from a gang culture in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Gangs were big in the 50s, obviously 60s, and he had a dot on his hand. And he would be driving a car, and I would be a little kid, 8 years old, and be like, Dad, what's that on your hand? And he would say, oh, that's where they tested out the ink before they gave me a tattoo. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. They test out the ink on your hand. All right, makes sense. But he really didn't want to tell me he was part of a gang, and that was their initiation. And his name was on his arm, so he had his own tag name even back then. His name was Bones. So I was like, cool, you got a nickname. You got a, you know, that's something cool. You got a street name. I want one, you know what I mean? So my mother and father got divorced when I was around 10, and I was looking for an identity. And a guy came down my block. He was like the Sylvester Stallone in my neighborhood. He was like a famous graffiti writer. And he seen that I had talent. I was writing in the street, playing around, wanted to be a graffiti artist. And he handed down my name, Caves, to me. So.
I think we're going to get to that, too,
yep,
when we get to your slide. Okay. Save that story because we're going to get to
all right,
your
so,
part. So I think this becomes like the way to introduce this kind of cultural immersion. Here was with Scene, and I'll, you know, let Mike speak to Scene and Sasha speak to Scene. But Scene was one of the first graffiti writers to start to cross over into tattooing.
Well, yeah, but he's also, you got to remember, Scene was one of the first like real superstars from Henry Chalifant's movie Style Wars, where a lot of kids. It was the first big, like real media attention, right? It was a film that made Scene into a superhero. And when you're young street kids, you're looking for your role models and your superheroes. Scene became that on many levels as a graffiti artist. So everybody all over the city knew who Scene was. So, and Scene also became a tattoo artist, and we'll discuss how that happened. And obviously, graffiti, my life story, the Pink Panther with the spray can, cool friggin' tattoo back, you know, in the late mid-80s, mid-80s? That's something, right?
But that's a perfect example of, you know, the Pink Panther would be something Scene would paint on the side of a train. And he obviously brought his own flair to the character, which is also a big part of graffiti culture, sort of being inspired by popular culture and putting your own twist on it. And that's a prime example of it.
Okay.
But yeah, Scene is one of the, if not the pioneer of, you know, seeing, I don't want to say reading the tea leaves, but looking at new ways to keep his art out there and keep him moving.
As graffiti, I mean, it was against the law, and as New York City became, you know, they elevated their pursuit in capturing the artist and cracking down on graffiti. Graffiti artists needed something, needed a place and an outlet. And actually, they weren't giving out many jobs to graffiti artists in those days. So you really had to, you know, you had to find some. A lot of kids went to airbrushing. There was a few kids that went to canvases and were, you know, were looked at as the gallery scene and picked up from the galleries. But that wasn't some, you know, on the street, you really had to invent something. And tattooing was something that was in your reach, right?
So here we see scene, you know, tattooing and opening up, you know, this is a photo of his shop in the Bronx and being one of, you know, like I said, one of the early graffiti writers to make that first crossover. And this is seen today in a photo that was taken of him by Esteban Oreo in the book. So next brings us to Med, who is another early pioneer who, while Scene was doing it, Med was simultaneously doing it, making that transition from a graffiti writer to becoming a tattooist. And, you know, as mentioned in the book, you know, Med had this kind of kinetic energy and, you know, was just out making a name for himself on this, you know, in the subway tunnels and on the highways of New York City. And that kind of wild lifestyle ended up, you know, getting, you know, Med into trouble, and it sent him upstate. And what's really interesting, though, is that, and I think this is like one of the to me was like something that I just found to be just really remarkable, was that Med was taught to tattoo in prison by a biker who was also a graffiti writer. So, you know, that right there shows, like, you know, these two cultures just, you know, not only clashing but merging it into becoming, you know, one and giving birth to something new. And here, you know, we see, you know, Med and Scene and Cope, and I believe it's PJ. You know, this is a photo from the book, but it was just I think Med and Scene were just really important. You know, without them, I think, you know, you wouldn't have had this
kind graffiti of graffiti writer scene a lane, like, wow, I can get paid to do art. And Scene and Med opened up a whole new door, because, like I said before, to step into a tattoo artist parlor back in the day, they chased you out. And in the graffiti world, there was a mentorship that was a little bit more open, where the kids, you know, got down with each other and were willing to share their styles. And of course, there was always competition, everything else. It was a very competitive sport, like tattooing. But if you knew crews and you knew people, you were able to get to Scene, or you were able to get to Med through somebody, you know, another graffiti writer to another. And there is a mentorship program that happened there if you, you know, deserved it. If you were, you know, hand-picked. I don't know what Med's story with Scene is, but I'm sure there was a respect there through the graffiti first. And then, you know, that opened up to a tattoo.
And what's really interesting here, right, is that so when we showed you how sailors, after going, you know, to the South Pacific or going to Japan and places like that and discovering tattooing, came back and started to create their own imagery and their own iconography, right, that was reflective of their experiences. Well, what happened here, right? It happened again. So you see these graffiti writers who are now tattooing, who they weren't getting down with, you know, maybe the biker stuff, or they weren't into the sailor stuff, so they started to create their own images that were reflective of their lives and putting that onto skin. And this is Med Shop up in the Bronx, which has become a tattoo and graffiti institution in New York City, tough city. And it was just really great to have him be a part of the book. And that brings us to Cess. So Cess has worked with Med and been a friend of Med for many years, and a prolific graffiti writer, and another artist who very early on made that transition from the walls to skin.
And there's thousands. I mean, he's another superstar in the graffiti and tattoo world. There's thousands of graffiti writers. I mean, when graffiti first started in New York City, how many writers were there?
Several thousand.
Several thousand. Now it's worldwide. There's millions, and Cess is a superstar in both worlds because of his days of painting and paying dues, and he had to work hard for it at least, over a decade or more. Cess, how long have you been doing it? Both.
Almost
30
years.
See, so 30 years of hard work. Now he's a superstar and was someone in this book that needed to be
connected. Like, the connection happens here. It starts off with Scene. Maybe Scene opened the door, and then Med. And then it's like
the subway system, and like we used to go write graffiti, it starts to travel.
Well, the other interesting thing is, in traditional tattoo culture, and Billy can name names, there are artists who are just well-known, who are famous, who have very specific styles, and people wait a year to get an appointment and they spend a lot of money because they want this very particular artist to do their art, do their tattoos. Now with guys like Med and Cess and Caves, they have very particular styles that are reflective. They're versatile. They can do lots of different things, but their tattoo style is very reflective of their graffiti style, and there are people who are fans of their very particular graffiti styles who seek them out because they want their graffiti-styled tattoo because they're fans of their work.
And I think also, though, what was really interesting to me about Med and about Cess, and yes, we'll get to it soon as well, but it was like they were able to take what they were doing on the walls and do it as well on skin. So when you see their their pieces or their graffiti-influenced tattoos, it wasn't like they were sacrificing the quality or the artistry to apply it to skin. They figured out a way to take it from a wall and recreate it, in a very comparable way onto skin. And this brings us to Yes Too, who is another member of the Tough City crew and another artist who...
He's in a disguise, by the way. The Groucho Marx disguise is there for a reason. Because he wants not to be anonymous, right?
So Yes Too was apprenticed under Med, and again, I think that shows another reason why Tough City was such an important institution for this movement, because you have not only Med, not only Cess, but another amazing artist like Yes, who was mentored out of that camp.
Generational, right?
Yeah, generational. Again, staying true to their roots as graffiti writers, but also becoming very accomplished and well-respected tattooists. Here we see, one of Yes's pieces on a wall, and then one on skin.
Who's that ugly guy? Jesus. So, you've seen the piece on the skin. So you can imagine for a graffiti artist, our pieces didn't last long on a train car. Either another writers would go over it or it would be buffed by the transit authority. So we were always looking to get up, to get fame, to be well known, to have the most. So, it's an honor to be in your tattoo parlor and all these people walk in and they want a Caves or they want a Med, an accessory, Yes piece on them, and they're your moving billboard now. And it's a little bit more permanent
subway car.
In a sense, now that there is no subway car, graffiti on them, it became a new canvas, a new place, a new billboard.
And that's me at 10 years old, 11 years old. This black book would be a
book that
would hand out to other artists, and they would contribute, and you would master your style.
So it took years to master your styles of lettering, just like in tattooing. It takes you
years to become a decent tattooist. you know, I'm tattooing for 15 years now or something like that, and every day you're learning. And every body that you tattoo, every skin is a new, it's like a train or a new canvas. You never know what kind of texture you're going to be working with. So every time you apply a tattoo, it's a new experience. And there's a story behind the tattoo, which there was always stories on the trains. Like Lee Quinones back in the early days, there was always a message. And I always was in love with that. It was like, you know, you got something to say, then say it. And that's how kids communicated, and that's how the tattoo artists were communicating, and that's how
I said, okay,
what do I have to say? You know,
yeah, this was stuff in the trains in the early 80s. It was something that was done very quick, and it was done in 2 hours.
You only had 2 hours time in the train yard before someone would chase you, a worker, a cop. I got arrested like right around this time in 85 in the train yard. So,
like tattooing, somebody walk into your shop and they want something done,
but they could probably only afford 2 hours, or they could sit for 2 hours.
So you have 2 hours to come up with a masterpiece that your name is going to be part of. So it better be the best.
You better put your
all and your heart into it, and
because it's going to represent you and your shop just the way it represented you on the trains
back when you were a child. I mean, the ego never leaves. It's always there. Here again, I was just 10, 11, 12 years old. And it was the idea of painting big and, you know, and becoming famous. I see it says world's finest crime. I guess we thought we were tough guys then. And I think it was the competition that we really strived on. And today in tattooing, it's the same thing.
Most tattoo artists
are very competitive. And,
you know,
I think you could speak to, as well, like your character here, right? Being,
yeah.
being reflective of you.
Well, that character there looks a little more reflective of Sasha, but I was trying to be cool, you know what I mean? And I was going through different neighborhoods and hanging out with black kids, Puerto Rican kids, and I would come back to Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and I would have a hip-hop style, right? I was wearing Lee's and Adidas,
and I was soaking in cultures from different neighborhoods and bringing it back
to my neighborhood, which wasn't always looked at as
a cool thing. It was like, you know, almost like an alien.
But it was something of it was a thing of ours. It was something that was felt original, and you felt like you're part of a society that was a secret society
that made you feel like something. Because, like I said, growing up
as a kid, you didn't have nothing, so you had to turn nothing into something.
So that's why
even you know going to those tattoo shops back then and getting a tattoo was a big deal because it reinvented you, and that's
what graffiti did for us as children.
It really gave
us an identity, and this works later on. And through graffiti
and tattooing, I mean, we started a band, and we still, that competitive spirit and that way to network, and I think I applied it in all aspects of my life, was those lessons I learned on the street on how to make a name for myself,
it continued on throughout my career in music and film,
and you know, we just make, you know, if you don't have something, you have to make it. And tattooing was another way where you didn't have to be a starving artist, because it's, you know, it sucks to be an artist and not get paid for your work. Tattooing is probably the only place where you actually get paid at that moment, where someone actually comes in and gets a tattoo and they pay you, and you're not waiting 6 months or 3 months or 30 days or whatever. You know, I mean, you do a job for a corporation, and, you know, Lord knows when you're going to get paid for your art, if you get paid at all, you know, because artists are always looked at, you could do that, you were born with that, you could do that anyway. You try that in a tattoo shop.
Speaking of money and art, bringing it all back really quickly to what I was saying, like, graffiti artists weren't in it for the money. They were doing it because they wanted respect and recognition amongst their peers within the subculture. In the early 80s, there was a movement, there was a gallery movement where there was real interest in, you know, what was going on. And there were guys who were becoming famous. You know, this is the era of Jean-Michel Basquiat, who wasn't necessarily a graffiti artist, but he, you know, was very friendly with folks in that community. And so you, in the early 80s, you had this movement of artists who were selling their work and becoming famous, and that's when sort of the mindset of graffiti started to change, and that's when You know, initially, a lot of kids who were into graffiti weren't artistically inclined. Eventually, within the aesthetics of graffiti, through practice and studying other folks, they developed stronger language skills, I would say. But, you know, because graffiti was appealing to young kids who were rebellious, who wanted to break windows, who wanted to go places where they weren't supposed to go. But, of course, within that bunch, there were kids who were more artistically inclined. And so by the early 80s, if you were a kid who was artistically inclined, you were sophisticated enough to understand, like, wow, like, you can be a part of this subculture and then maybe make money selling your art and doing, you know, things that go far beyond the subways. You know, there were folks who started to do commercial work and all of these things that are very common now. But by the late 80s, which I think sort of helps where we're going and transitioning to where tattoo and graffiti merge, two things happened in the late 80s. Subway and graffiti in May 1989 was pretty much completely eradicated. And at that point, even by 89, a lot of folks who were really prolific within the subculture had moved on because of age, because of life and responsibility and lots of other things. And the other thing by the late 80s, the folks who were really successful as artists who came from the community were having to become bike messengers because the galleries and all the folks in Europe and the people here who had great interest in the art and who were spending money stopped spending money. So you have legendary guys like Futura, who is really on top of things now, is doing really well. Futura was a bike messenger and was working at Kinko's for many years. And so by the late 80s, early 90s, tattooing, you know, for a graffiti artist who, I'm not doing illegal graffiti anymore, I'm a grown man, I have responsibilities, I'm still artistically inclined, you know, I have an eye for art, you know, what can I get into that will continue my passion and make a great living for me and can also help me continue my quest to build a name for myself and have respect and all these things that are very inherent and important within the subculture.
Yeah, well, you want to make a career. Like, everybody would like to have a job that they love and to do something that you love, you know, in the art field. Tattooing was very appealing, and like I said, there was only a few people doing it in my neighborhood that were any good at it. And there was legends. Mikey Angelo was a legend. I thought it would be great if I could do it. I thought that would be you know, an honorable profession. And I saw it when I thought, how am I going to find, you know, how am I going to do this? I said, well, I know about, you know, two guys in the Bronx that are doing it. Well at it. So Scene, of course, you heard that he made the transition, but Med, I met through my travels. I think we met at a show, at a hip-hop show, and I heard that, you know, he said, congratulations on your band, and I said, well, you know, you're doing tattoos, congratulations on the tattoos, come see me at my shop. So graffiti used to be very territorial, so, you know, right away, comes, you know, you're meeting other writers. If you're old cat, you're like, at first you're like, but this guy was very open and very kind-hearted, where he was just like, yeah, come check me out, come get a tattoo, and, you know, come check out my place or whatever. A few years later, I said, you know what, let me hit up that guy Med. He seemed like a cool cat. And to a friend, Jess, I told Jess I was interested in maybe perhaps tattooing, and he made a call to Med, and Med was like, yeah, you know, we're all part of the same culture, we're part of the same family, this graffiti family, come down and talk to me. And that's the way it happened. Just like that graffiti, just through that graffiti network, those doors opened up and it became a mentorship, and we opened up a shop together. And that's how these pieces started connecting. So just like, you know, the graffiti crews would connect with each other, we started connecting as tattooists, just as we did as kids.
What's really interesting, too, then about Med is that, so going on the circuit, and we had this, you know, I had this conversation and learned this. And the question, Med was one of the, not only did Med go from graffiti to tattooing, but he took tattooing very seriously. And there, in the tattoo culture, there are these things called tattoo conventions. And that's how artists, you know, get to know each other, and they travel, and you go and you, you know, you set up a booth at a convention center and you work and you tattoo people. and it's a big part of the culture. So I asked Med, when you first started showing up to these tattoo conventions, and they were dominated by bikers or, you know, kind of motorcycle enthusiasts, did you feel that you received the backlash, right? Like, did you feel as if you weren't being accepted? Because, you know, in a way, now you were like the fringe of the fringe. And Med, what I found interesting, the answer was no. That actually, like, when he got there and started showing these guys his work, they were like, oh, shit, like, that's kind of cool. And I think that could be attributed to them, whether you're a biker or a graffiti writer, you're that same archetype, right? You're that outlaw archetype. And you share in the, you know, whether your upbringings may or may have not have been different, or the crews or culture that you exist in may be different, you share that same kind of sentiment.
We're all pirates. It's like an outlaw art, recognizing outlaw art. I mean, but tattooing was very closed. I mean, with there, you know, I mean, it wasn't like you could just walk into a tattoo shop and ask how to tattoo. But with the graffiti writers, we were closer to each other. And I think Matt was generous to give out that information. But yeah,
you had to be very serious about it.
So,
my shop in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and you know the shops. You try to make them like
home.
You know they're part of your growing up. They're part of your, you know, it's like you're inviting people into your
home because it's a social place. And tattooing, it's about that. It's about community and about you're tattooing generations. Like people getting tattooed, they're bringing in their children. They're you know you'll have a client for the rest of your life if you're a good tattoo artist and an honorable one. So I wanted to make a tattoo shop more as a social club or as a community, a public house, where you can come in and get your therapy on for the price of a tattoo. So, you know, that's... And the graffiti, yes, is a big part of my life because it's how I came up through it. And I matured into this you know, this business I have now, and we're going to get into, you know, I went over to California in the early 90s and with my band, and we were friends with Cypress Hill and House of Pain and whatever else, and I discovered a whole lifestyle that was was very similar to my Brooklyn upbringing. It was the Latin, the Chicano, Mexican kind of family, you know, honor, and I met Cartoon. And Cartoon was tattooing, and under, I believe, Baby Ray, he was just learning. And he was taking the graffiti art and the black and gray style and now, you know, doing tattoo work and he tattooed one of my band members was probably one of the first people he tattooed, but he went on to becoming a very famous tattoo artist for his black and gray work and on his work for musicians like Cypress Hill and Eminem.
In the same way that you had tattooing, right, like all happening simultaneously, so people were getting tattooed out in, you know, the Polynesian Islands, people were getting tattooed in Japan, sailors are getting tattooed. Again, it's that inherent thing about marking one's body, so it's going to exist everywhere, you know, around the world without maybe people even knowing that each other are doing it. Well, that was kind of happening, right, in California. So whether, you know, California may have been very influenced by New York graffiti, but it was, again, that inherent thing about marking the wall, making a mark, leaving a mark. And while guys like Caved and Scene and Med and Sass were doing it in New York, you had Cartoon doing it in L.A. And then making his transition to skin. And this was a tattoo that actually, I think, tattooing within hip-hop culture has exploded, you know, over the last 10 years. And this was a very big tattoo, I mean, for Mr. Cartoon's career, I think, and as well for just hip-hop culture in general. I think this was on the cover of Rolling Stone or Source magazine. I forget which magazine it was on the cover of, but that tattoo, when it hit the cover, like people were just like blown away within tattoo culture, and I think that really, I mean, within hip hop culture.
I think that was 50 Cent act piece that he did. Brought it to popular culture, where his tattoo work just exploded, and he went from doing, you know, getting paid a few hundred dollars an hour to like, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, you know, for an arm piece, or you know, $40,000 for a back piece, something ridiculous like that, and well deserved. I mean, he was tattooing celebrities that wanted to spend that type of money for this style of tattooing, and like Billy was saying before, we were sharing styles. Like, California was influenced by New York, and then we went out to California and we were influenced by that style, and it was like exchange, always constantly exchanging of style, and that's what's great about it. Bob was another guy that is another 6 degrees of separation of Med and I. Bob is a California tattoo artist that also started out as a graffiti artist and was airbrushing on Broadway back in the day.
Tell about your story too, right? Your connection to Bob?
Yeah, well, Bob is another guy that Med introduced me to Bob. Bob came to New York, and he was another guy that was didn't believe in holding back and keeping it a secret. He you know, gave me my first apron and a tattoo machine, and was just like, you know, here's how you use a liner or a shader.
So the graffiti writers were a little bit more giving than say a traditional tattoo apprenticeship. And again, you know, we see another manifestation of an artist like, you know, Baba taking what he was doing on the walls and applying it to skin.
Yeah. And there was early books that also got around, like subway art and spray can art were graffiti books that traveled through graffiti artist's hands. And so people in California knew what kids were doing in New York and vice versa. And that's how people started recognizing each other. And in the tattoo. Norm's an up-and-coming guy that came under like Bob's crew, or MSK.
And he's a guy that's actually doing it non-traditionally.
Take
what he did on the walls, his hand style, that people are flocking to him now
to get his hand style, his graffiti hand style on their skin. Influenced by New York City graffiti, seen it in California, started painting buses and trains out there, freight trains. Freight trains was another thing that were traveling around the country. And he was looking at what was
going on in New York, decided to pick up a tattoo machine
and
get into work. He works at Baba Shop.
Now, Giant is a very famous graphic designer. Am I right?
What would you call him? Artist.
Fine artist, graphic designer, tattooist. From Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, here's how the book kind of like strings it all together. I had a young kid that followed me around when I got a little older that wanted an apprentice under me.
In the
graffiti world. And, you know, of course, I gave him a hard time and whatever. He had to pay his dues.
And so I took a liking to him and showed him a few things. And he inherited some of the Bay Ridge Brooklyn style.
And then he left. He got in trouble, and he moved out to New Mexico and bring that Brooklyn graffiti style to New Mexico and started a whole graffiti movement, which was it wasn't heard of out there. And he brought this New York City style, and he met Giant and mentored Giant, where Giant said his name is Agree. Agree showed him a thing or two about graffiti, and he was off to the races.
So
it's trippy how close of a connected we are. And he's colorblind, by the way, so. A lot of his stuff is done black
and white. And
the color stuff he does, it's wild how he does the color stuff. I really don't know the method. I think he talks a little bit about it in the book.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just, again, like, it's just so,
it's amazing, you know, to just, you know, recreating that on skin, right? And skin being this, you know, this canvas that's always changing, right? Every customer is different, right? Like every customer's skin is a different texture, right? It bleeds, it sweats, it moves. You know, I think that's a similarity too. If, you know, as far as painting on a train, you had a limited amount of time, right? The train was like right here, you know, in front of you, and you kind of had another train behind you. You couldn't really see the full scale, you know, scope of what you were about to paint.
The difference is the train doesn't talk back to you. There's right. Some of clients, so they talk back to you. Andy Regan's another guy that mentored at my shop, and he was a Boston kid, and then went back to Boston and opened up his own shop, Hourglass Studio. So he's working out there now, and he's another guy that came up in the music scene, came out to Brooklyn, was looking for a shop to tattoo out of, and because he was a graffiti artist, you know, I took a second look at him, and he came in and dropped a few names, and that dialogue begins, and you know, that mentorship, he learned under, I think, Omni James in New York, and then came over to Brooklyn, spent time with us, and then went back to Boston. So it's a close family, and it's a 6 degrees of separation. Like I said, like Sasha was saying, this is before the internet. This is how we communicated. This is how we still communicate, and continue to kind of. We are a small family in a community. Tattooing is a big movement, and we like to consider ourselves that we have a niche in it. So the book definitely reflects that, and it's an important tale to tell because, you know, you have to tell your story, and this is some of the stories that are told. There's another guy from his shop, Hells. He's in the book. He has an amazing story as well.
He's out of Boston as well.
That's awesome, awesome. Most fascinating. You know, back in 1992, my husband and I went to visit family in Florida, and they asked us, so what's going to be the next big thing in New York? And I said, tattooing. And this was in 1992. And my husband said, no way. And I said, definitely.
Yeah, you're like the Miss Cleo of intellectuals.
So the program is being audio recorded, and we're opening up the floor to questions from the audience. Just raise your hand, and I'll bring the mic to you.
I can't resist asking Caves a question. I was thinking about both graffiti and tattooing as being arts that you really have to learn by doing. There's not really any other way to get to where you want to get to. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the first time you did a tattoo, or maybe even better, the first time you did a tattoo that really you felt like embodied your vision for what you wanted to achieve.
Yeah, it is difficult. It's the first thing I would describe tattooing like drawing with a sewing machine. At first, when I got it, it just felt that awkward, you know. And you start out tattooing grapefruits or pig skin. I know, and with graffiti, you're a toy. They call you a toy when you first start out. You're scribbling with chalk in the street, and you hope to advance to spray cans and markers. But you have to practice. And I spent, you know, hours and hours, you know, in the corner of my room learning how to master, you know, the styles. So when I started tattooing, of course I went to what I know. Like, you write what you know and you paint what you know. So it was lettering. It was the first tattoo that I said, okay, I know I could do that in case the stencil goes away and I can't see it. I have to rely on my skills as an artist, and graffiti is what I knew. But as I grew as a tattooist or as an artist, the neighborhood is what inspires me. Growing up in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, and the landscapes of that. So when I was able to do a landscape of the neighborhood and do Brooklyn underneath it with the lamppost, I said, oh, that's my shit right there. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to be known for that. Like, Michelangelo was known for his script. You know, you have to find something that you're going to be known for. And like a little kid, I was like a kid at Christmas, like, okay, I found something that, you know, now there's thousands of kids that
tattooed that on them.
And they're very proud of,
you know, I got a Caves Brooklyn tattooed by me with the lamppost with the street, you know, number in it. And, you know, as
and people come from Japan and let me, you know, tag my name on them.
I mean, how honored, you know, it's like, you know, it's I couldn't ask for anything
more.
I mean, not to put it in words, a body of work, no pun intended, you know? Hope that answered that.
Hi. The early cave painters were very respectful of other artists' work. If you look at the paintings, they never cover another image. Would that be true of graffiti artists?
No, that was actually the opposite. Because there was a lot of in the early days, people were respectful. You know, everybody was like, it was like 60s. It was like everybody was peaceful. The hippie generation, let's smoke a doob together. Towards the 80s, everybody, the kids were angry, you know what I mean? And space was limited. So you paint a train car, and somebody come along and go over your train car. A lot of wars happen that way, a lot of beefs happen that way. But if you were
better than most, either if you were better or you carried a bigger
stick. That's how your art stayed respected, because you had to earn your respect. And that either happened because you got up the most, or you could burn. That was the title that we used. That your style was undeniable, so people knew better, you know? And then you had to be attached to a name or a crew.
But you're also competing with the MTA, you know? The MTA had a system of, as we say, buffing the trains. They would run the trains through this acid thing that would basically burn the stuff off the side of the train.
They didn't respect it.
But what I was going to say is I'm currently working on another book about graffiti, and I interviewed this week, interestingly enough, two graffiti artists. One woman, her name is Lady Pink, and she, with this guy, is the Wiz, painted a train, a memorial train for John Lennon right after he got shot. And she talked about how that train ran for years and years and years, not only because there was a certain level of respect within the graffiti community because of who the artists were, but out of respect for the Beatles and John Lennon, not only did graffiti artists not deface it or go over it, the MTA, the guys who were tasked with cleaning the trains, left it alone. And interestingly enough, another person I just interviewed did a famous piece that said, "Dump Koch." And in the O had, like, you know, Koch's face. And he talked about how that train ran for a real long time, too. And there were other things on the train, on the same train surrounding it, that would get clean. But clearly the workers who worked for the MTA let that train go for a lot of years.
Koch neither.
Yep.
And there's also rules as well, right? That so it was like, and they weren't always followed, but it was that, you know, a throw up goes over a tag, a burner goes over a throw up. So depending on how intricate the piece was, and how developed it was, you wouldn't go over it if it was maybe like with something less developed. That was the original.
And if you were going to go over someone, say you painted something, you'd have to paint over it completely. If I were to paint over your thing and you can still see remnants of what you painted, that's seen as a sign of disrespect. So if you painted over me and didn't completely paint over me, I'm going to cross you out, or I'm going to go over you. So ironically enough, there's a code. So if you're going to paint over someone, you better paint over it entirely, so there's no traces.
And also in tattooing, there's also a code, and you like to, you know, to believe in it, that if someone comes in with another artist's work, you don't touch their work. It's disrespectful. So you try to talk the customer out of, let me do another piece for you, or you should go back.
You can cover it, though, but not, you're saying alter it?
Well, he was saying,
you've got to completely cover it.
Right.
But if, you know, if that other guy, you can't kind of like go into the other guy's work, and same with graffiti.
In the book, there's a few stories. I mean, Hells tells a few stories, and Med tells a few stories as well about, like, when they were, you know, in what is known as a graffiti war, when someone's going over your stuff, how it becomes like, where like you go do a piece, you get home, before you even could get into your bed for the night, like someone that person went out and wrote over what you just did. So now you've got to get up and go out before people see it in the morning, right? You get a call like so and so just went over your stuff, you're going back out to go back over them, and it's just this never ending cycle.
Well, that's interesting, this idea of painting over another artist's work. Picasso and Modigliani traded paintings, and Picasso was in the studio. He didn't have any canvases. There was Modigliani's painting. He painted it over and did a whole other image.
They started a beef. Yep.
Well, I see on the picture up there some aerosol cans, and I think there's like a battle between the MTA and the graffiti writers, but as I understand it, if you're under 21, you cannot purchase those or possess them, and there's actually people out enforcing this. There was an artist arrested on Friday night for having two cans of aerosol, and he spent 20 hours in jail. Where is this war or this battle that's going on at the cultural level? That's my question.
Well, graffiti was always looked at as it truly is an American art form, you know, that is so ingrained in pop culture now as a dialogue, as a communication, the way we speak, the way you look at ads from Pepsi to Nike to Coca-Cola using graffiti artists, and you see a Banksy being sold for $1 million on canvas, bless you. But then you have, places like New York City that treat graffiti art as like a stepchild, that don't want to recognize it as an art movement that was developed here, and there's not a place for it. So they want to lock up the tools for it, and they think that's going to stop a kid from expressing themselves. Have you ever seen Revs? You just take a bucket of paint and write his name, big bucket of paint, you know, on the side of your building. Kids are going to express themselves. They need an outlet. So instead of slapping them on the wrist, give them an outlet. You know, give them a place. You know, and I mean, I've argued about it many years. I mean, there's skate parks, but there's not art parks, right? So
it just boils down to money. I mean, it's America. It's this great American art form, and it comes from the spirit of America. America is about, you know, Boston Tea Party and not wanting to pay taxes and all these things, but America is obviously extremely hypocritical, and graffiti is very indicative of that hypocrisy. And, you know, unless there's money in it for the state or whatever, you know, instead of investing money in giving kids something, an outlet, you know.
Well, that's why tattooing is perfect. You want to find a kid that's young enough to walk into the shop and say he wants to learn and do something creative and positive. Hey, you want to get up? I'm sure you can get, you know, your name on thousands of people walking around saying, who did that tattoo?
But, yeah, you know? And I think it's also, but it's very cultural as well, because you could, like, if you, let's say, again, going back to cave paintings, right, this inherent thing, human beings, we want to mark walls, we've been doing it, right? It wasn't against the law at that point, right? And even tattooing, like, marking ourselves. So Western society in America, right, tells us it's taboo. They tell us that, you know, it's for criminals, it's for outlaws. But, no, it's actually what we as human beings, some of us just want to do. And, you know, like I was in Samoa some time ago, and I remember getting off the plane at the airport, and like all these people who were just like, you know, whether they were working at the airport or just like people within the, you know, from the community, or just like looking at my tattoos, and I was like, kind of like, I felt like a little bit like, you know, as if maybe years ago you may have felt walking around with tattoos showing like people might have been perceiving you in a certain way. Right, but then they came up to me and they wanted to like, they were like wanted to see him and touch him, and they were like so mesmerized by him. What I later realized was because within Samoan, you know, culture, tattooing is for kings. Right, tattooing is for.
Are you a king out there?
I'm a king. I'm a king in Samoa. He's a king in New York. I'm a king in Samoa.
Uh-oh. I'm a lord of Brooklyn.
But yeah, so it's you know, a lot of cultural bias.
Hi. You touched on something earlier that I wanted to ask you about originally. So there's this kind of phenomenon that anytime anything's cool or kind of racy, someone wants to brand it. So just what's your perspective on, brands using things like graffiti and tattoo to reach consumers?
It's great if the artist is getting paid for it, you know. A lot of times the artists, you know, are not getting paid. There's a lot of companies that will take a picture of a wall and say it's theirs, when actually it's the artist. So if they're commissioning the artist themselves, I mean, it's great, because it shows you that we broke through, right? And now it's our time, you know, for something that we've been doing for over 30 years. So It's a shame when it doesn't go that route, you know?
But it's also culturally a different time. I grew up in New York City where there's a tradition. Someone gave you a marker. It's culture, right? And the New York spent a lot of money to break that culture. So when I go back to my neighborhood in Astoria, my mom still lives there. You know, obviously kids now play video games and they don't go outside. But there's not an older guy who's like, okay, here's your name. Here's how you write your name. So the cultural aspect of it has been completely broken. So then your question becomes, well, the people who understand how to speak this language, is it cool if they make money from selling the language to people who want to mass produce it and sell it to regular people? And so, yeah, it's cool. You know, people who are a part of the culture, who still care, who maintain the culture to a certain extent, are getting paid to do it on a mass level. But I think the sad part of it is this sort of cultural development that was indigenous to New York and Philadelphia and a lot of other cities has been broken. And it's also easy to break, you know, culture by way of stiff penalties and also capitalism. It's like, you know, if you're a kid who's artistically inclined, you know, are you going to go run around and sweat and, you know, develop this language and get this respect from the subculture? Or are you just going to, like, draw in a book and go to art school? You know, so I think that there's something that's kind of lost in what's happening.
Well, what makes graffiti and tattoo so exciting and different than all other art forms is that it has never had any kind of academic foundation. And that's what really makes it unique. This is a good time to actually move on to book signing. We could go on and talk about this for much longer time. And I'd like to dedicate tonight's program to the memory and spirit of Richie Haven.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Right?